Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, September 7th, 2014, and this is show number 487. Well, before we kick in, I wanted to remind everyone of a new way to listen to the NoCellaCast live. Did you know that you can listen to this show live on Alpha Geek Radio when each episode is recorded, even you're away from your home computer? It's crazy. Just point your mobile device browser to mobile.alphageekradio.com to tune in. There's also an application called TuneIn over at tunein.com that gives you additional features for the mobile listener. Simply search for Alpha Geek Radio within the TuneIn app and enjoy listening live from wherever you are. If you need to look for a channel, look for Channel 3 to find the NoCellaCast, and you can also get it on reruns throughout the day along with a bunch of other shows, which is super fun. We do have people here from Alpha Geek Radio, and I'm excited to have them here. So this is just fun to have all these different ways to listen to stuff. Last week during Security Light, Bart, or it might actually have been me leading him in the wrong direction, mistakenly said that there was a breach in the security at the United States Postal Service, or USPS. Alert listener Kevin from Connecticut sent us a note telling us that it was the United Parcel Service that had the breach and their subsidiary, the UPS store, not USPS. Kevin elaborated that two of their stores in Connecticut admitted that they were compromised. Thank you so much, Kevin, for sending in the correction. Would hate to mistakenly accuse someone. Well, I've complained about my Apple TV for a long time, and I thought it'd be good to do an update. If you haven't been playing along with our home game, it might be fun to do a little bit of a review. Steve and I brought the original Apple TV ages ago, and I pretty much hated that thing from the minute it got in our house. It didn't do anything I wanted it to do, and even with the hacks available at the time, we still hated it. I hated it so much that I tweeted out that for $50 I'd send it to anyone who wanted it. Now, to tell the truth, it actually cost like $200, so that was a pretty good deal, except it didn't do anything. Jonathan Koss jumped on the deal, and I shipped it off to him, and apparently he's been quite happy with it over the years. When the Apple TV 2 came out, we gave it another try, and that one wasn't bad at all. In fact, it was pretty cool to be able to rent movies and that sort of thing with the device. Life was good. In fact, so good that we bought a second Apple TV 2, and eventually we bought the third generation Apple TV when that one came out. When AirPlay came out, it became even more fun. We were a bit disappointed that Steve's MacBook Air was just a couple of months too old to have AirPlay. Even though I had a MacBook Pro that was slightly older, it was able to do AirPlay. But we bought AirParrot, and that works sort of okay. Lately, it doesn't seem to want to send audio with his AirPlay content, so I guess it doesn't work that well for him now. Well, anyway, every Friday night, we rent movies via the Apple TV. Until one night, when it stopped working. We rented a movie, but when we tapped on play, it said that it would take 6 hours and 12 minutes to play the movie. I went online and I found that people had run into this problem, and they solved it by logging out and laboriously logging back in and going to check for rentals, and then the movie would play. We tried it, and sure enough, it worked. Yay, problem solved. Till the following week when it happened again. This time logging out and back in did not fix it. We tried everything, and we kept getting these huge download times. Now here's a couple of factors to consider in this problem. We have 50 megabits per second download speed from Verizon Fios. The Apple TV is on Wi-Fi on the most recent model, Airport Extreme. Right next to the Apple TV is a Roku 3, which is on the same wireless network. Nothing's wired, everything's wireless, but they're side by each. And finally, movies rented on Amazon Prime via the Roku play immediately. In fact, they're the same movies I can get through the Apple TV on iTunes. So why does that not work? Now, Steve and I are engineers, and we believe in scientific experiments, using control groups and all that kind of thing, changing one thing at a time. So testing the Roku side by each on the same network was a significant data point. We believe we'd eliminated the network from the equation, but then we started thinking, what if the Apple TV itself had a problem? We swapped in one of our Apple TV second generations from another room, and we had the same exact long delay before starting a movie. So we've eliminated the network and the device. Week after week, ever hopeful, we'd rent a movie on iTunes, be unable to watch it, go over to the Roku, rent it from Amazon Prime, and watch our movie. Then while we watched the movie, I'd go over to Apple and complain, and they'd give me a refund. After 3 weeks in a row, they even gave me 3 free rentals on a service that won't let me play the movies I rent. I was real appreciative for that. Oh, and by the way, they're $3.99 rentals, so even if I did succeed, rentals are like $5.99 for an HD movie, anything recent. So they didn't really give me much help, and I can't glop the money together or anything like that, so they're just probably going to sit there forever. So that pretty much brings you up to date to this week. We do turn the Apple TV on for other things, like HBO Go, and we happen to tap on movies. we noticed that the little movie posters weren't rendering anymore. A couple would render, but it would be mostly like these gray little ticket-looking things that would be sitting there. They got me thinking, maybe something was wrong with the Apple TV after all, and maybe it was a red herring the one time we tried it with the Apple TV second generation. We decided it was time to do a full reset of the Apple TV. Probably should have thought of that a long time ago, right? Well, anyway, after the reset, I had to use that horrible Apple TV remote to type in the Wi-Fi password, my Apple ID, and my Apple ID password. So about 12 hours after I started that, I was ready to try renting a movie again. We crossed our fingers and we felt really optimistic about this whole effort because now we could see those little movie posters. We went back into movies and we rented Snowpiercer, a post-apocalyptic movie about the last survivors of Earth all trapped on a train. It's a pretty fun movie, by the way. We were so excited because we were certain that we'd be able to watch the movie. And up came the message, ready to play in 5 hours and 3 minutes. Seriously. My favorite part is how they suggest that it's your problem. They tell you if you lower your expectations and set your Apple TV to standard def, maybe your poor, weak little internet connection will be able to keep up. Right, I just paid for an HD movie, and I'm going to go play it in SD. By the way, we did test that, and that didn't work either. We decided to wait it out this time, and we saw the message drop to 4 hours and something. But then it went up to 6 hours and something. We chatted for a bit, and after about 5 minutes, the movie was ready to play. Now, you might be wondering whether I've tried to wait it out before, and the answer is yes. So the bottom line is that I may have fixed the problem with my Apple TV, but in any case, it's idiotic that these messages keep coming up with such absurd problems. Stay tuned.
Hey, everyone. Donald here from Otakuno Podcast, here with a review of a product with the rather tongue-twisting name of Rocker Sound Cube Portable Wireless Bluetooth Stereo Speaker System. Of course, we start with a problem to be solved. I like to listen to podcasts while doing chores. It helps cut the boredom and helps keep me motivated. I also like to listen to podcasts while I'm, you know, out in the yard, sitting out under the shade, enjoying a nice sunset, or lounging by the pool, or in the pool, or whatever. Now, I've got an iPhone 5, and it has a fairly loud speaker in it, but it's not quite loud enough to cut through the noises that I make when doing chores, for example, you know, washing dishes, vacuuming, laundry, yard work, and so forth. So I need some sort of external speaker. It also has to be wireless because, well, as I do chores and stuff or walk around the house, I tend to, you know, walk around a lot. And so I need to remain mobile while I'm out and about so I can't be tied down by a wire. You know, I could just see it. I'd be vacuuming or whatever, and then all of a sudden I reach the end of my wired speaker cable and then boom, end up pulling something off the shelf and death and destruction commence. Now, in the case of listening to podcasts while in the pool or near the pool, I do have a waterproof case for my phone. It's actually one of those dry bags that were reviewed back on the Nozillacasts many moons ago. The problem with that, though, is, well, it's a sealed environment, which you want for a waterproof case. But that also means that there's no air inside for the sound waves to pass through. So you can't hear the phone speaker through the case, which means you have to use, it has actually a little pass-through plug for headphone jacks, so you actually can use headphones or earphones with it, but using headphones in the pool doesn't work so well. I know they make waterproof earbuds, but, well, I'd just rather use a speaker, okay? Now, fortunately, there are a plethora of Bluetooth speakers out on the market, and prices on those have come down quite a bit. I mean, you can get decent ones for around $100 or so. Unfortunately, that's a bit over my price range at the moment. Well, while I was browsing around Amazon one day, I happened across the Rocker Sound Cube Portable Wireless Bluetooth Stereo Speaker System for only $22.99. And, well, since it's Amazon we're talking about here, you know, they're pretty good about, you know, no-hassle returns, I figured, let's give it a shot. These speakers are clearly a ripoff of the Jawbone Jambox Mini. I mean, the styling is virtually identical, even down to the box that it came in. The form factor of the speaker itself is also pretty much identical to the Jambox Mini. It's a square, sort of rectangular brick, about 6 by 2 by 1.5 inches, and weighs about 8 ounces. The top and the bottom are covered with a rubber-like material, and the speaker grille is metallic. On the top of the unit are controls for play, pause, previous song, next song, and phone, you know, to answer phone calls and stuff. On the right side of the unit are the power switch. Yes, it's a switch, not a button or anything like that. A mini USB connector, which as far as I can see is only used for charging. An aux-in jack, which means you can use this speaker as a wired speaker as well. And finally, what looks to be a micro SD card slot. And finally, the unit has red and blue LEDs to indicate the status of the unit. You know, whether it's charging, whether it's in pairing mode, and so forth. This unit features Bluetooth 3.0 plus EDR and claims to have a range up to 33 feet. It has a built-in 800 milliamp hour lithium ion battery, two 40 millimeter speakers for a total of 6 watts. And as I mentioned before, it has an aux-in port, which means that you can use it as speakers for other devices, including your laptop and so forth. And supposedly, with the micro SD slot, it can play MP3 files that you load onto an SD card that you put in there. Unfortunately, I didn't have a chance to test this feature. So what are the pros? Well, the build quality on this is surprisingly good. It feels pretty solid. It doesn't feel plasticky or cheap. It doesn't creak when you squeeze it, etc. Pairing the device couldn't be easier. Just turn it on and a voice will announce that it's in pairing mode. Then just open Bluetooth on your phone or tablet or whatever and find the device in there, tap it, and you're done. The sound quality also is surprisingly good. Clear, not mushy. It can get really loud without noticeable distortion. Not so good on the bass end, but that's not really of a concern for me since I'm using this mostly for podcasts. Actually, the bass sounds okay, so even if you did listen to music on this, not that Allison will know anything about that, it would still sound pretty decent. The battery life is also pretty decent. It got about 4 hours of battery life and takes around 3 hours to charge using an iPhone AC adapter. It also came with all the cables that you'd need, including a mini USB to regular USB used for charging it, and a 1/8 inch aux audio cable. Finally, there's the price. You get a lot for only $22.99. But there are a few downsides. Although the sound quality is good, there are some limitations. For example, there's lack of stereo separation. Because the two speakers are very close to each other, you don't get that wide sound stage that you would get with traditional separate speakers. But again, since I listen mostly to podcasts, that's not a big concern of mine. And as I mentioned, the bass is also a bit on the weak side. It actually sounds okay, but you know, if you're into bass-heavy music, you probably won't be as impressed. But again, I'm using it for podcasts mostly, so you know, no problem there. Unfortunately, as a Bluetooth speakerphone, this thing leaves much to be desired. When I'm in a phone call, I can hear the other party fine, but they cannot hear me very well. They tell me my voice comes out kind of muffled and hard to understand. For me, this is not a deal breaker because, again, I'm using it mostly as a speaker for podcasts and audiobooks, but your case might be different. This is not a dustproof or waterproof unit, so you can't actually use it in the pool or like on the beach or whatever. I probably wouldn't use it there, but beside the pool is fine, assuming you know you put it far enough away that it you know has less of a chance of getting splashed. Now, it advertises a range of up to 33 feet. In my testing, I found that I only get about 10 to 15 feet, and that's outdoors with no obstacles or whatever. But bear in mind that my iPhone usually stays in my pocket, and since we humans are ugly giant bags of mostly water, Allison, did you get that Star Trek reference? I was probably blocking some of the signal, so if the phone is out in the open, you might get actually better range, I don't know. But 10 to 15 feet is more than enough for my needs, so I'm okay with that. The battery life on this thing is okay. The strange thing is, on the Amazon description, they actually state 2 battery lives. On one part of the page, they say 4 hours. On another part of the page, they say 8 hours. So, you know, there's some confusion there. The actual battery life is right around the 4-hour mark. So maybe the 8-hour figure was a typo, or maybe they accidentally pasted in some descriptive text from a higher-end unit or something. It also seems to discharge pretty quickly. So, meaning, you know, if you leave it off of its charger but not use it, it'll still discharge at a fairly quick rate, requiring you to plug it in and recharge it. Given my needs and the low cost of the unit, these are acceptable limitations for me, but they may not be for you. Battery indicator is, in a word, not so good. There is no actual battery life indicator on the device itself. The only indication you get is when the battery is really low, a voice comes on and says that the battery is low and please charge it as soon as possible. Now, on some devices, including the iPhone, you will actually see a battery indicator for your Bluetooth device. It's a little teeny tiny battery bar right next to the main battery bar up in the upper right of the iPhone. That's because this speaker will actually send battery life data over Bluetooth. So, you know, the phones that can decode that information will display it. Unfortunately, this has been pretty unreliable. Sometimes the meter appears, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it shows obviously bogus data, like, for example, almost empty, even when, in fact, I literally just finished charging the thing, and so forth. Some people on Amazon have also complained about the flashing blue light. While the unit is on, there's a blue light that flashes, I guess, to indicate that it's still connected via Bluetooth successfully or whatever. Some reviewers found that annoying. One person said that it's annoying when you're using it in a car at night. I don't drive, so I wouldn't know about that. Another person said it makes it impossible to use in a bedroom. I don't really see that as being a problem, since I would very rarely, if ever, use it in this kind of situation. There are also people that complain about the voice prompts. Kind of like the Jambox, it actually prompts you by voice. For example, when you're in pairing mode, pairing successful, and so forth. Some people found it annoying. I didn't. It is awfully loud, however. But fortunately, this is something that only happens once, right when you first turn the unit on. It announces Bluetooth device is connecting, and Bluetooth device has connected successfully. So, not really a big deal. It can only be paired and used with one device at a time. So, for example, if you have both an iPhone and an iPad, you can't pair it with both and use it simultaneously. There's also no way of triggering voice control or voice dialing for such as Siri. There is a button that is used to answer phone calls, but that's all it does. It can only be used to answer a phone call, reject a phone call if you long press it, or redial. This unit does not come with a power adapter, so you'd need to use your computer to charge it, which is slower, or you could use any other USB charger, for example, the charger that came with your iPhone or iPad. It takes about 3 hours to charge from empty with an AC adapter, and obviously if you're charging it with the computer's USB port, which delivers less power, it'll take longer. When you start playing an audio, you know, music or podcast or whatever, the first second or two of the audio gets cut off. But I've seen this happen with other Bluetooth devices as well, so it might just be a Bluetooth thing and not specifically having to do with this specific speaker itself. Now, you might be saying, you know, that's an awful lot of cons. And yeah, there are some annoyances here, but consider the price at only $22.99, you know, you might think, eh, I can live with that. So what's the verdict? You get surprisingly good performance for not a lot of money. There are a few cons, but they're not deal breakers, especially considering the price. I would say if you're looking for a Bluetooth speaker and you're on a budget, this is a definite buy. Check it out at the links that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes, and check out otakunopodcast.com if you're all curious about Japanese animation, anime, comics, manga, food, travel, culture, so forth. Hope you enjoyed the review, and I'll see you next time.
Hey, Donald, thanks for the review. Really appreciate it. We're looking at pictures of this during the live show, and boy, did they rip off the look of the Jambox. This thing looks exactly like a Jawbone Jambox. It's got the little sort of diamond-shaped waffle pattern on it. Looks about a little smaller, maybe, is the size of the small one. But, hey, if it gets a job done for $23, who are we to argue? I mean, I'm using $34 Bluetooth headphones, so why not? All right, let's see. I have a big... wonderful thing for you guys if you use Facebook. Now, if you don't use Facebook, this you aren't going to care one little bit about it. But a while ago, Facebook started auto-playing videos. This is incredibly annoying to most people. I haven't heard anybody say, wow, that's awesome. It was so hard to click that play button before. And a couple of bad things happen. If you're on limited bandwidth, you're sucking up bandwidth watching videos that you don't care about. Like if on your cell phone, you're going to get it, and on your web browsers, you're going to get it. Not only is it annoying to look at, but you're paying for it, which is even worse. So if you're as sick of autoplay videos in Facebook as I am, you might appreciate a little tutorial I created. Can you guess what tool I used? Anyway, I created a tutorial to show you how to shut the darn things off. Now, it's oddly not that hard to find in the web-based version of Facebook, but that fix is only available in Chrome, not Safari. And I don't quite understand why that is. I posted in Facebook how to do it on Chrome, or I'd done it on Chrome, and I posted it in Facebook, and all these people said, well, that button's not there. I don't see it. And they were sending me screenshots, and they didn't have the very important button that said videos. So I went back and discovered that, sure enough, you can't do it from Safari, but you can do it in Chrome, and it shuts them off in Safari. So it's almost as good. They really hid this. On iOS, they hid it in a completely different place, possibly because Facebook uses WebKit, as does Safari, so it's the same problem. That's why you can't do it in iOS in the same place. But don't worry about it. In any case, there is a link to my tutorial in the show notes. If you do a search on how to disable autoplay videos in Facebook, you'll find it there. And there's a link in the show notes from this week to show you how to do it. It's not hard, but it is hidden.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, Arthur has sent in our dumb question for this week, and here's what he wrote to me. Hello, Allison. I have a question for you. I hope it qualifies as dumb. We really have set the bar high, right? During episode 484, you said that the NoSilicast news is opened more than 50% of the time. How did you figure that out? I have my email client, Thunderbird, configured to not download stuff from third-party websites. Am I counted? Best regards, Arthur. Well, I thought that was a great question. I'm not sure how the tool figures it out, to be honest, so I'll tell you how it works, what I see. I use a tool called MailChimp. It's online and free for my kind of quantities. I create a campaign when I have a special announcement, I should say, and I have an RSS-generated newsletter campaign that does the automatic spitting out of the newsletter every week. So it's actually two campaigns. I do specialized ones, but then there's an RSS-generated one that goes out every week when it senses that I've posted a podcast. Here's what's happened so far with just the most recent one, as of when I was writing back to him anyway. It looks like I did exaggerate the industry average, but I'm still usually above 50%. Opens where the industry is at 18%. I think I said they were more like 5. The latest one only went out the night before I checked those stats, so it's a lower number as to be expected. I can also see from the clicks that I'm getting a higher percentage than the industry, which leads me to believe that some people like the newsletter as a way to get the links delivered to them, so they can listen to the show and then right there in their email they've got the links ready for them. After I wrote him that, I started to get curious, and I did a search for how MailChimp knows if you've opened the email, and I found this. When campaigns are sent through MailChimp, we embed a tiny invisible graphic in the bottom of your HTML email. This opens a tracker graphic or web beacon, which is unique to each campaign you send. Each time someone opens your email and views the images within that, that open tracker graphic is downloaded from our server. Each time that graphic is downloaded, we'll count that as an open on your campaign report. Open tracking, along with click tracking, is an easy way to measure subscriber engagement. Back to Arthur, if he is successfully blocking download of stuff from third-party websites in his email client, then I'm guessing that he isn't counted. Now, Arthur and I spoke a little bit more after I finished writing that up, and he told me that he looks at it in the preview pane, and I'm guessing that if the preview pane actually does show, has that tiny little graphic in there, that maybe he is counted. But if somebody else knows more about that, I'd sure like to know, because it's a dumb question corner, and I think I've pretty much come up with half an answer. Well, I may have mentioned a few hundred times that I'm a big fan of Clarify. It gives me even more pleasure when I find someone else using it. I was looking around for some instructions on how to control Google Hangouts on Air, which is how I'm doing the live show these days, and specifically how to integrate the events feature. I think events allow you to announce stuff in advance, and then you sort of stick a Hangout in Air inside the event. I haven't got the hang of it yet, though. Anyway, I was looking for help, and I did a search, and I found Barbara Schroeder, also known as Boise Barbara, over at edtechtoday.com, had made a tutorial on it using Clarify. She even said it's an awesome tool. Anyway, this is a simple little four-step tutorial she made, but she did a great use of rounded rectangles to identify things to click, and she used the sequence feature of Clarify to tell you in what order you should click those buttons. It's just the kind of thing that if you described only in text, it would be super hard to follow, but since Barbara used Clarify, you couldn't possibly get mixed up. Clarify is available through the Mac App Store, or you can get a free trial from clarify-it.com. They've got licenses for Mac or Windows, they got cross-platform licenses if you're a slider, and they've even got volume pricing. Ian Douglas, for example, just took advantage of the volume pricing, buying 10 copies for Windows at work. Check it out over at clarify-it.com. It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and we're doing another time travel episode. This is Bart Bouchotte's, still here on the previous week, but showing up on the following week.
So basically, this recording is straight after all the fun we had with Automator. So if the whole security world has ended, you'll probably have heard me inserted in telling you that it's, you know, the world is broken. But otherwise, I have no idea what happened in the security news. My crystal ball is on the fritz.
So we looked at everything Bart had ready for us last week, and there was too much fun. So we have split off Taming the Terminal to be its own episode, which I think it's September by now, Bart.
Must be.
All right. So, like you said, we're not going to have any Security Light unless you just finished hearing Security Light, in which case we did. And we're going to tuck into Taming the Terminal Part 20 of N.
Indeed we are. So, where last we left off, we'd spent two episodes, I don't know, installments, two thingies, talking about regular expressions. And then we spent a thingy talking about searching for text within files or within streams using egrep. And our lovely regular expressions we learned two previous times. And now it's time to continue the searching theme, but we're not looking for, you know, which file contains which text. We're looking for files based on a whole raft of criteria. Mm. Right? Because egrep will help us find files that contain something. But it's not checking the name of the file or anything else about the file. It's just, so it can only be used on text files and only if the reason you're looking for the file is because of what it contains. And that's not the only reason you might be looking for a file. You might want all files that are bigger than 4 gigs. You might want a file with a certain file name. You might want a file with a certain file extension. You might want a file you edited within the last hour. You know, you saved it, you don't remember where, but you'd kind of like to find it again. You know, all sorts of things you might want to search files for other than just the text that's inside them. And so that's where the very well-named find command comes in.
I like that.
So nice and straightforward. How do I find stuff?
Are you sure find isn't spelled with like a PH or something like most commands in the terminal that are...
Nope, this one is completely intuitive.
Oh, okay, fine.
Well, okay, no, as far as his name goes, it's completely intuitive. It goes a bit off the rails after that. But
it's downhill from here. Great.
So regardless of what it is you're looking for, so you can search by as many criteria as you like, the structure of the command is always find, followed by where it should look, followed by what it should look for. So find, path, criteria. And criteria can be like one criteria, two criteria, four criteria, 100 criteria.
So that's not too bad. That's like find in the kitchen the beans and the corn.
Correct, but you have to remember to tell it where to look. And the thing is,
find the corn and the beans in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Okay.
So you may be tempted to say find star.jpg. No, you have to tell it where to go look. It's not going to know what to do with findstar.jpg.
So it won't look everywhere if you do that?
No, if you want to look everywhere, you say find space slash star.jpg, and it'll go look in your entire hard disk.
Let's not do that.
That will take time, right? If you have a 3 terabyte hard drive and it's pretty full, that will take a lot of time. Right. Now, the thing to bear in mind is it's a recursive search always, by default. You can force it not to be recursive. We'll get to that way later down. But by default, it's going... So if you say, look in my home folder, it's going to look in every folder inside your home folder as well, which is kind of what you want 99.9% of the time. And so it's kind of nice that it does that without you having to tell it, oh, go be recursive.
That is kind of nice, but unusual, right?
Very, yes.
Usually you should tell it that.
A quick reminder of stuff we've covered before. Useful things to remember are that the little tilde symbol, the squiggle, is shorthand for my home directory, which is a place you may be doing a lot of searching. And the full stop, the dot symbol, is the current directory. And you may want to search the current directory. So tilde and dot are very useful with find.
Okay.
So really, 99% of what we have to talk about today is how we define our criteria. So let's start simple. I would like to find files based on their name. So in other words, we want to say all files whose name matches something.
Okay.
And so the flag for doing that is minus name.
Oh, man. That two things in a row are intuitive. I'm comfortable with this part.
Now, I'm going to give you some more of this kind of advice, which is to a slight extent, do as I say, not do as I do, because I learned this the wrong way and I wish I hadn't.
Oh, okay.
If you are searching with minus name, you are allowed to use special characters like star to mean any amount of anything and question mark to mean exactly any one character. But those symbols have a meaning to bash, so you have to escape them. And escaping is ugly if you put backslashes in front of everything and you're prone to forgetting. So the habit I would like everyone to get into is whatever you give after minus name, put it inside single quotes. So quote it. This is exactly the same advice as I gave with EGREP last time.
Right.
Get used to single quoting it, and then you just won't go wrong.
Bless your heart. Because I don't even try to get those backslashes right. I just drag files in and watch and look and go, wow, I never would have remembered that that's the concept, the way you're supposed to do it.
So in this case, I'm saying just get used to the idea. Anything that comes after the minus name, inside the little single quotes, and then you'll be safe. So these things always make more sense with examples. So I sort of came up with two examples based on stuff I do in the real world. So a lot of the time someone says to you, hi Bart, I'm having trouble with my blah, please help. And I have no idea how their computer is set up or how their server is set up, but I know I need to change something in, say, php.ini, because that's PHP is often troublesome.
Okay.
So I just need, okay, so they could have installed PHP using MAMP, in which case it would be in /application/MAMP/something or other. Or they might have installed PHP through one of those Mac ports or something, in which case it's in a completely different location. So I have no idea what they've done. So I just want to say, where is php.ini?
Okay.
So I would say find space slash space minus name space inside single quote php.ini. Hit enter and wait. Now, this will work, but there is a slight side effect. If you're running find on slash and you're not doing it as the super user, you're not allowed in everywhere. And you'll get a little message saying permission denied, permission denied, permission denied, permission denied.
Oh, yeah, now, it's spitting that all over my screen.
Yeah, because you're saying, look at everything, and the computer's saying, well, actually, you're not allowed in here, or here, or here, or here. So there's two ways around that. If you know the file is somewhere that you are allowed to look, you can just make the errors go away by, do you remember we learned in the episode entitled Plumbing, which was in Solomon 16, we learned that if you do /dev/null, it sends standard error to nothingness, into the black hole. So if you run that command and stick /dev/null at the end of it, then the errors will still happen, but we'll never see them.
I do remember talking about that, but two,
and then the >/dev/null.
Every time I see that, I think about the fact that Leo Laporte played a fictional animated character called Dev Null on TV a long time ago. Okay, well, it's not spitting permission denied in my screen, but it's still running away. Oh!
Yeah. And it, well, did you find the php.ini?
Yeah. Well, I have a bunch of them because I have backups of my web servers, and I also have MAMP on my machine, I think.
Oh, well, there you go. And in fact, MAMP has a lot of them because MAMP comes with loads of different versions of PHP, so you can test your app in lots of different versions.
Oh,
so you have lots of php.inis if you have MAMP.
Okay.
So that works. Now, maybe you actually want to genuinely search everywhere. Maybe those error messages were telling you something you needed to know, in which case the answer is to put sudo in front of the command so that you actually have the power.
I think that's what I would do first, probably.
To be honest, yes.
But using devnull is fun.
Exactly. So we can find a file with a given name, but the chances are we actually want to find a file that matches some sort of pattern. Now, this is not a regular expression. This is a very basic pattern like you would use when typing CD, you know, ORM star.txt or whatever. Think like your old MS-DOS days. It's that kind of pattern. So if you want to find...
I have no MS-DOS days, Bart.
Really?
Nope.
Oh, you were on the Mac.
Yeah.
You lucky person, you.
Never had to do that.
Okay, but it, you know, star.exe is sort of in everyone's mind anyway.
Sure, sure.
So
by the
we
way,
can use
I would like
kind of
the audience to be excited right now. My phone is ringing outside the door, and we are not disconnected this time from our Skype call, which is what killed us last week to you guys.
How? Yeah, I'll talk about that offline. That just boggles my brain that the phone can somehow interfere with the Wi-Fi. But anyway, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So as our second example, let's look for all text files in our home directory. So find space tilde space means find in my home directory, minus name, star.txt inside our single quotes that I really want you to get used to using. And that will find every text file in your home directory, which in my case is a lot. I don't know how many people use text files.
Yeah, let's see how many I got here. Oh, yeah, a whole lot.
A whole lot, okay.
Oh, all my Evernote, everything is a text file. Log files are text files, Bart. There's a million.
Okay. So there are plenty.
Yeah.
Now, a second example. How's about every text file that begins with the letter B?
Okay.
Find space, tilde space, minus name, bstar.txt, inside single quotes.
Well, that's taking longer to find any.
Yeah, we've asked it to make a more difficult pattern.
Oh, okay. So, oh, permission denied.
Oh.
Permission denied.
Are you searching in tilde?
Oh, no. Yes. Find space tilde space dash name.
Interesting. So there's something in your home folder you're not allowed into.
In library, saved application states for Adobe Flash Player.
Huh.
Who's got Adobe Flash running anyway? Yeah, no, I don't have any text files that start with the letter B. How interesting.
Okay. I went and created one called bart.txt because the next pattern is any text file that's four letters long with an A as the second letter. So question mark A, question mark, question mark dot txt, right? This is just to illustrate the point that you can take these patterns quite a long way.
Okay.
However, there is a slight limit because these are not regular expressions. So what if I want to look for all JPEGs? JPEGs can be .jpg or .jpeg. But I want all JPEGs, so I need to search for both. Well, there is a flag called minus or, which allows you to have two conditions. So find space tilde space minus name space star.jpg minus or minus name star.jpeg.
Oh.
Probably find a lot of files.
I'm not going to do that, Bart.
Well, you can watch a few scroll by and hit Control C.
I know.
Well, okay, Control C will always break you out. So you can do it and watch a few scroll by and hit Control C.
Okay.
Just to see some JPEGs and some JPGs intertwined.
Okay. Yeah. That's just watching. That's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Now.
So let me go over that slowly, though, for just a second. So what we said was find. And then the dash or the tilde was to tell it in our home directory, dash name. And now we're saying we want to look for .jpgs or .jpeg. So we put a dash or. Oh, but you have to say dash name again.
You do, because maybe, right, we're going to learn that there's lots of other things we could search on.
Oh, okay. So the second or might be something else.
All JPEGs bigger than 500 megs, right?
Ooh.
Now that would be a very big JPEG. Probably not a good example, but you know what I mean.
Right.
So it's. What type of search, what we're searching on, or what type of search, what we're searching on, or what, you know, you can have as many ors as you like as well. Now, we're almost there, but some cameras, and I don't know why, have this annoying habit of saving it .jpg in all caps.
Oh, and it's not going to find those because the...
It's not gonna find those.
Because the terminal is very literal.
Yeah, it's case sensitive. So, there is the minus iname, which behaves exactly like minus name, except for the fact that it's case insensitive.
Ah.
So if we replace the minus names in the above example with minus iname, we will then capture everything. So .jpeg, .jpeg, .jpg, .jpg, you know. I don't know, yeah. Shouting. All caps are shouting to me. Anyway.
By the way, so, can I back you up?
You can, please.
I am using the command that you gave me before, the earlier one. I got a little bit behind because I had to create a file called Bart. Oh, never mind. No. I did the find tilde dash name. Oh, never mind. You used question marks.txt. It's finding all kinds of junk. Oh, I had a lot of stuff in my home directory that had, never mind, that had the second letter was A. It really was finding the right stuff.
Yeah, because that is all the test is. Is it four letters long with the second letter A?
Yeah. So why again? I missed it. Why did you do
so? Question mark means
instead of star. So
question mark means one of anything. Star means any amount of anything.
Say one more time.
Question mark means exactly one of anything.
Okay.
So something a something something dot txt.
But stars would have meant
any amount
number of characters
something.
Ahead of time. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. All right. So that's what I did first, and I got all this glop, and I'm like, those aren't fitting the rule at all. Okay. Sorry to back you up, but I wanted
to that's good. That's
repeat
good.
That. So now I've caught up to you where you're talking about the capital letters here.
So minus I name means a case insensitive name match. No, it doesn't matter whether it's uppercase or lowercase, we're going to match it.
Because searching for JPEG did not find enough files on my computer. Case insensitive.
Well, you may be interested, right? I mean, okay, in reality, you're probably not going to point it at your whole home directory. You're probably going to be looking for something with a little more specifics.
Yes, possibly. Okay.
So minus I name is the same as minus name, but it doesn't care about the capitalization. So it's case insensitive, hence minus I name.
Okay.
And so between minus I name and these minus ors, you can do a lot. And that'll probably cover you at least 90% of the time. But sometimes you're going to want the full oomph of those regular expressions we spent two whole shows learning about.
Okay.
And you can do that. The criteria for using regular expressions is instead of minus name, you say minus regex. And if you want a case insensitive regular expression, it's minus I regex.
Okay.
And now we have some caveats here. Okay. Caveat the first. So if you remember back to our regular expression discussion, I said that there are two kinds of regular expressions. The old ones that are difficult and ick, called B or E's, basic regular expressions, and the shiny new ones called extended regular expressions. And we only learned extended because they're cool.
Okay.
By default, the find command uses the crappy ones. Okay. But don't worry, we can tell it to have some sense. You just have to put the minus capital E flag straight after the word find, because it will apply to the entire command. So find space minus E space tilde minus I regex and then the pattern. So I've rewritten the pattern here to find JPEGs as a regular expression because that's actually quite a neat little regular expression.
Wow, if I were just listening to this, I would have had trouble following that. So I hope you people are following along with the text.
This, particularly the regular expression is very visual, right?
Yeah, so you said find, then you said dash capital E, and that gets us to the good regular expressions.
That says for this entire execution of the command, whenever I give a regular expression, I want it to be one of the extended ones.
Right.
So we flip the mode.
So we said flip the mode to extended regular expressions. Mm-hmm. Then you said tilde to say, where are we going to look? Then you said minus I reg X, so that it's case insensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking for regular expressions. And then you put a bunch of glop between single quotes.
So inside those single quotes is our regular expression. Now, so the first caveat is don't forget the minus E. The second caveat is when we were using egrep, it would return us a line if any part of the line matched the pattern. And so we had to remember to put our hats and our dollar signs around things. The find command insists on matching the entire thing. So it will only return it as correct if the whole thing matches.
Okay.
And the whole thing is actually not just the name of the file, it's the whole path. And so to get something ending in JPEG, you say dot star, meaning any amount of anything, followed by open square brackets dot close square brackets, or an actual dot, followed by the letters JP, then an E with a question mark. Do you remember what the question mark means in regular expression land?
I'm hoping it still means anything.
It means one or zero of whatever was to my left. In other words, the E is optional.
Boy, Bart, that's too subtle. I'm not going to remember that. But I'm still stuck at the beginning. Why is there a dot before their first star?
Okay, so we are in regular expression land.
Yeah, right? We're not in find anymore.
No, we are now in regular expression land, so we need to think regular expression. And remember, I am pretty sure I have never needed regular expressions in the find command. But since we spent all that time learning them, I'm going to tell you how to use them, right? I have yet to come across the need in the real world. So if this doesn't make sense, turn your brain off and join us again in a moment.
Okay.
In regular expression land, dot means any character. So dot star means any amount of any character. So we're saying anything followed by an actual dot, then the letters J and P, and then the letter E may or may not be there, and then the letter G.
Okay.
So anything followed by a dot, then a JP, maybe an E, and then a G.
Okay.
Which gives us .jpeg and .jpg.
Okay.
Right? The thing with regular expressions is they're very... You can say a lot with very little characters because that command is an awful lot shorter than the one above, but it does exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
I believe the phrase is dense, which has two meanings, and they're probably both appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, it does get it done in a lot fewer characters, but you have to sit and think an awful long time to do it.
Unless regular expressions are second nature to you like they are to me because I use them every day. Okay. But, right, you know, the point being, I figured I should tell you how to do it because this is powerful stuff.
Okay.
But if you don't care, you don't care.
Okay.
So now we're going to move on to something that, tune back in again. Tune there. So that's names, right? Very useful to search based on file names, but there's other things you might care about. And so an important one is modified time. Mm. So the flag for doing this is minus...
Where the heck is that file I just finished saving?
Right, yeah. Oh, sugar, I didn't look. I just hit Command S and didn't look. Sugar, where'd it go? Yeah,
I do that. I was just using Chrome to download a picture from OneDrive, and I did a right-click, said download, and it said, yep. No idea where it is. I checked. Chrome is set to put stuff in my downloads folder, but that's not where I put it.
Lovely. Yeah, so this would help. So the flag is minus C time, which in your brain you should remember as change time.
Oh, okay.
And it's minus C time and then a number. And the number by default is in days. But you don't necessarily want to think in days, but you don't have to. So you can then, after the number, put a letter. If you put an S after it, means seconds. If you put an M after it, means minutes. If you put a H after it, means hours. If you put a D after it, means days. A W after it, means weeks. And
so is this elapsed time or specific time?
Elapsed time from now.
Okay, so I need to know if it's an hour ago.
Yeah, now, one final very important point. You want to put a minus sign in front of the number or it just won't do what you think it should.
Huh, why?
So everything you've done in the last hour, let's say everything in your documents folder edited in the last hour is find space tilde slash documents with a capital D space minus C time space minus 1H. So that is everything with a change time that's less than an hour ago.
Huh. Okay. That doesn't seem overly... Yeah, it's go back in time by 1 hour, so minus.
Yeah.
That's intuitive.
You just have to remember to do it, otherwise you get back the weirdest of results.
I got it.
And likewise, you could do minus 1M, minus 1S, minus 52S, whatever. And of course, you could chain these together. So you could say find tilde documents minus C time minus 1H space minus name star.jpg and only find the JPEGs you've edited in the last hour.
This is worth paying attention. Regular expression stuff made my head hurt, but this is cool. I just change it to check in the last couple hours, and it's finding the AIFFs that we're recording right now.
I should really well hope they're changing.
I hope so.
The next thing we might want to look is...
Can you define what changed means?
Okay.
No.
I won't quite say no, but that's complicated. Yeah.
Okay, then let's not do it then.
Change means that the actual content of the file has changed. There's also altered time, changed time, and modified time, if you really want to know.
Okay.
Trust me, C time.
Okay, C time.
I lost a half an hour of my life this afternoon figuring that out. Because I looked at the man page and went, modified, changed, or altered? I wonder. Anyway, so C time is what works.
Okay.
The next thing we might want to look at is based on the size of a file.
Yeah.
And that is minus size. And like minus C time, minus size wants you to give it a unit. And the unit, well, you don't have to, but you do have to, really, because the default, if you don't tell it what it is not something sensible. It's the amount of 512K blocks the file takes up. Now, who thinks in half megabytes?
Ah, come on, that's intuitive, Bart. Jeez.
Of course it is. So you pretty much always want to give it a unit. So your choices are C, which means byte. Again, The reason is because a character is a byte long. Therefore, C for character is C for byte.
Okay, so a character would be like the letter L?
So the ASCII representation of the letter L is 8 bits, kind of. Look, C means byte. Well, realistically, you're not going to look for something that small. So what actually matters is K for kilobyte, M, lowercase k, capital M for megabyte, capital G for gigabyte, capital T for terabyte, and should you be so desirous, capital P for petabyte.
Yes, I need to deal with those all the time, so I'd be using the P.
I'm just impressed that it goes that far.
That's the only person I know would need that is Don McAllister for the size of his files, probably. But.
Or Google.
Yeah, there's that.
The index of the web, please. Ooh, that'll be a couple of petabytes.
So I can skip characters and not try to remember that one, right?
Yeah, the C and the P really don't matter. It's lowercase k, then uppercase MGT.
Why is the K lowercase and the M uppercase?
I don't know.
Kilobytes usually are lowercase k. That makes sense.
Mm. Now, these are the old-fashioned 1024-based thingies. So it's a mibibyte, a gigabyte, a tibibyte. I just spotted the typo to fix for later. A pibibyte, if you're going to be correct about it, right? Because SI units are kilo means 1,000. Anyway.
I'm going to hit my head on my microphone if we talk about
that. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox for that one.
Okay.
Anyway, right. Megabytes, gigabytes, terabytes, petabytes. Okay. Useful. And also, so if you don't put a symbol in front of that, it means exactly that amount. But we don't really generally want stuff that's exactly 500 megs. We probably want stuff that's at least 500 megs or less than 500 megs.
Right.
Minus sign means less than, plus sign means more than. So if you want to find every file in your downloads folder that's bigger than 200 megs, find space --downloads with a capital D, space minus size, space plus 200 capital M.
Hmm.
And in my downloads folder, that's far too much stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to have to look someplace else because... No, the other way around. Mine's really clean.
Oh. Oh, well, you could change it to a minus sign and it'll show you everything that's smaller than 200 megabytes.
Yeah, there's just not enough in it to be entertaining.
Okay. Well, the other one I have in the example is everything in your downloads folder is smaller than a megabyte. So minus size, minus 1M.
Okay. Ooh, I'm looking for things bigger than a gigabyte. That'd be a fun way to go looking for what kind of junk you... Oh, man, I got an interview with Robert Lloyd Lewis from a long time ago. I probably don't still need that's over a gigabyte.
There you go. Yeah, so if you're short on space, this is actually quite useful.
Holy cow, that can't be right. I put in plus 1G, and it just found a chit-chat across the pond from August.
They could go bigger than a gigabyte, especially if it's the one that's come out of... What format's it in? If it's an AIFF, I well believe that. Yeah.
No, they're not that big. Well, go take a look at this stuff when it's done.
Hey, if
I only knew how to pipe this into a file or something...
Going to have to stay tuned a little on that one because I'm going to blow your head off later. But actually, I'm going to tease blowing your head off, which is very mean of me. But
oh, no. Because that's what I want that.
Well, you think you do. Anyway, okay. I'll leave the teasing till the end.
Okay.
So the next thing we might want to do is filter the file type. And when I say file type, I mean that in the Unix way, not in the human way. Because in the human way, a file type is .txt, .jpeg, and so forth. In the Unix way, a file type is, am I a file, am I a folder, am I a link?
Oh, okay.
So if you only want to find folders, it's minus type space D for directory. If you only want to find files, it's minus type F for file. If you only want to find symbolic links, it's minus type L for link. So realistically, your only care is F or D, to be honest. In other words, I am looking for files or I am looking for directories.
Okay.
And a lot of the time, you're not actually going to care because how many people have directories called something.txt?
Right.
Probably not many. But if you're looking for a different search, it might be a problem. So if you get back a whole bunch of directories and you don't want them, minus type space F, problem goes away.
Okay, cool.
So as an example, right, I have this terrible habit of creating... little temp folders, which I always put the word temp in the name somewhere, but I don't always get around to cleaning up. So I could combine the minus type D with a minus I name to give me a search for everything in my documents folder that is a folder that has the word temp somewhere in the folder name. So find space --documents with a capital D for my documents folder, space minus type space D for directories or folders, space minus I name star temp star inside single quotes. In other words, anything temp anything or every folder containing the word temp.
Huh.
And in my case, that actually showed up a few.
I'm finding which I will really go clean up. Weird stuff. And oh, I know what this is. Hey, cool. I can get rid of this. Thanks.
Excellent.
I was trying to burn a DVD using an application called Burn. It was an open source app, a free app to test for Dorothy, whose brother-in-law, I think it was, needed a free way to burn a DVD. And I burned a bunch of temporary files, so I had a whole bunch of audio underscore TS and video under TS folders. Cool. You just saved me some disk space. I was going to say, I never do those temp folders, Bart. There was three gig.
Yeah, we all do.
Thanks.
Three gig. Something else we might want to do is we might want to turn things around. So we might want everything that's not a JPEG or everything that's not an MP3 file or everything that's not something.
Yeah.
And to do that, you use minus not. So you put minus not in front of what it is you want turned upside down.
Okay.
So as an example, I have a folder that I keep all of my MP3s in, and the only thing that should be in there is MP3 files. So if there's anything in there that's not an MP3 file, I would like to know about it. So the command to find all of the outliers, so I wrote the command first, I ran it and it worked, but of course it showed up 20kbillion.ds_store files. So I rewrote the command.
Wait,
so it ignores...
tell people what ds_store files are. Those are the resource forks, I think?
No, they're not the resource forks. The resource forks are even different still. Every folder in OS X has one of these in it because it tells the finder stuff like, how I have the, you know, do I have this folder in one view or another view, all that kind of...
Oh, okay. Okay, got you.
So it's the state of the folder within the finder.
Right.
That was actually in there. And they're everywhere. But they start with a dot, so the finder doesn't show them, but the terminal commands will all find them.
Okay.
So one of the things we want to do is minus not minus name dot star. In other words, a file which starts with a dot.
Okay.
So in other words, hide all hidden files. So the full command, putting it all together. So now, this will only work, you've got to put in your own path here, right? But in my case, I keep my MP3s in a folder called my MP3s in the music folder, because I'm very original. So find space /music/my MP3s, minus type F. So
you're looking for files.
Looking for files. I want to ignore the folders because, of course, there's folders in there because I've organized it all because I have.
Okay.
Space minus not space minus iname *.mp3. So not an MP3 and not.
And you did that dash iname because not a capital MP3. I mean,
correct.
You want to look for capital and lowercase in case you messed up.
Exactly, and then say not. So if it doesn't end in either MP3 or MP3, we don't want to see it. And also we want to exclude anything that starts with a dot.
So not
minus
name.
Not, minus name, dot star.
Okay.
And that works. And I found a bunch of PDFs in there, which when I looked closer were the little booklets inside CDs. So I guess they're okay.
Oh, interesting.
So I could put a minus not dot
did you
PDF
scan in
well.
Your CD booklets?
I must have done. I don't remember doing that.
Wow.
I only found like five of them, but I did find them.
And you allowed them to stay.
I did allow them to stay. I was very generous.
Okay, so in a more generic sense, you could see that there'd be cases of where you want to look for not certain things, is what you're illustrating, right?
Exactly. So it's often you know what's wrong and you know what's allowed and you want to find everything that's not okay. So minus not and then the pattern for what's okay is often very useful. And it's very Englishy, minus not. Just like the minus or was handy, the minus not just turns it on its head.
You know, this is immediately useful to me, Bart. And, you know, I'm
good.
A big fan of the tools that allow me to look for where I've used up too much disk space, right? Where I'm looking,
yes.
I'm looking to recover disk space. I do it all the time. But the problem with my hard drive is it is, or my solid state drive is it is completely dominated by my Gigantor Aperture library, which is over 500 gig now. So anytime I go to look for anything, the stuff I really care about is might even be buried inside my Aperture library. Like I have movies in there that have snuck in that I've just discovered by looking for things bigger than a gigabyte. Well, if I could look inside my Aperture library and say, find me stuff bigger than a gigabyte, because if I got something bigger than that, there's something wrong. That I should have little tiny clips.
My camera didn't give me a JPEG bigger, or didn't give me a RAW file bigger than a gig.
Or even if I have video files, not a gigabyte.
Smaller.
Those are not. If they are, there's something else I got to do with them. So this allows me to look inside that blob of stuff that's too big to deal with. It just dominates. It ruins all my results.
Yes. The last well, not the last of the criteria that I'm going to talk about is actually sort of not really a criteria. The last thing I want to say is, so I said at the start, it looks through all folders inside whatever you give it, and that's usually what you want. But it may not be what you want, because you may know that what you're looking for is only two levels deep, and it's going to waste its time looking all the way down. So maybe if you know it's only two levels deep, maybe tell it don't go further than two. Or maybe you know it's at the top level, so don't go further than one. And the way you do that is with minus max depth. So minus max depth one means don't be recursive. Minus max depth two is be recursive, but only once.
Only a little bit.
Minus max, yeah. Minus max depth three, et cetera, et cetera. You get the idea.
Huh.
And especially if you have a giganta My Documents folder and you know the stuff is near the top, because mine is huge. And if I don't put the minus max depth to something sensible, mine takes forever to search.
Oh, right.
Because
right.
It's just huge. So that's a good way to speed things up a bit.
See, that's why we should be using FAT32 from the old days, because you could only go, what was it, 64 characters deep, including the path name? Was it 64?
Yeah, I don't remember what it is, but it
something
might have been
small. Maybe 32.
Nah, no, couldn't
have been that.
Could it?
Because I remember Lindsay had
trouble. There is a limit, yeah.
We were trying to run backups onto a FAT32 drive, and it kept failing in all these files, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And Lindsay had created a file structure that was 11 levels deep by like what year in school she mm-hmm. was, what the class was, who the teacher was, the period, the week, the month, the day, the year. And so it just couldn't do anything with it. But see, that would limit us then.
It would, yes. So the next sort of thing is, so we've now looked at all these criteria. We've sort of mentioned the fact that we can do a minus not and a minus or, but we can take things another step further. So if you'd like to get your propeller beanie on, we can do full Boolean algebra here. So we can make like sub criteria. So we can say this or this and that or that, all those kind of things. But the first thing to say is if you don't put a minus or, it assumes you mean and. So if you have minus I name this, minus I name that, mentally you should read that as this and that. So if you don't say anything, it assumes and. So I've written out to prove this my search command for my MP3s, and then I just put minus and in, and it does exactly the same thing, because that's what it means. But you can also group these things, and the way you group them is with the round brackets, the parentheses. But, this comes with one of those annoying buts again. The parentheses have a meaning to bash. And if it has a meaning to bash, what does that tell us?
We have to put it in single quotes.
Exactly. Or escape it, which is horrible and we both hate.
Right. We're never going to do that.
If you want to start a little subquery, you basically quote, quote, open bracket. And then if you want to end one, quote, close bracket, quote. Sorry. Quote, open bracket, quote, close, quote, close, close bracket, quote. That's hard to say.
Oh, wait. Without repeating that last part you said, what is the... So you put the quotes around the parentheses so that it doesn't get interpreted by bash.
Yes.
Huh.
So to make
I thought
this,
the whole thing would end up inside the single quotes, but you just put the open and close parentheses on their own are inside single
yes,
quotes.
Yes, because they are separate little chunks. You want to give it to find as an operator. So find basically is told, I need minus size this... Oh, start a new group. Do this, do this, do this. Close that group. And you can nest these to get really insane. So just to give a practical example, because this sounds so weird in the abstract, let's say I want to find all PowerPoint files that are bigger than 100 megabytes.
Zero.
Which is...
Oh, sorry. That was just
Oh,
me.
I wish that were true in real life. One of the things about working in education is that lecturers have to upload notes to the e-learning system.
Yeah.
And if you use a giganta JPEG... PowerPoint is too dumb to actually resize that for you. And so you can very easily end up with a 500 meg PowerPoint. And then the poor student on a dial-up, well, not dial-up these days, but on a poor home internet connection is trying to download 500 megs worth of stuff to see your four-slide description of something silly, right?
I was saying zero when it was, are there any PowerPoint files, Bart?
I know.
But I was lying. Oh, man, they're all full. They're in my mail. Oh,
people
for the
send
love
them attachments.
Of what?
I know. So a realistic thing to want to do is to find big PowerPoint files. And my criteria for big is greater than... Ooh, I've just realized another typo to fix. According to my show notes, it's 100 megs, but according to the actual command, it's 500 megs.
Okay.
I'll pick one of those in the show notes will match. Whatever our criteria is, above, we'll say 100 megs, because that's actually, anything bigger than 100 is too big for a bloody PowerPoint, right?
Right.
And PowerPoints can be PPT or PPTX.
Okay.
So, in other words, a size greater than 500 and a name of one thing or a name of the other thing.
Right.
So, if we don't use the parentheses, that
it
won't
would do
be interpreted.
And PPT and PPTX.
It'll do and PPT or PPTX. So every PPTX would match because it
wouldn't apply the 100 megabyte requirement to it.
It wouldn't be right, yeah. So we can just be explicit. We can say, look, don't leave it to interpret. Let's just say what we mean. So we say find tilde documents minus size plus 100M starting a new group. And inside that group, you have minus iname star.ppt minus or minus iname star.pptx. Close the group. And now we have bigger than 500 megs or and is a PowerPoint file.
Okay.
And so that, you know, using that same logic, you can expand that out to the most complicated queries on the planet. We have all of the Lego blocks to build anything we want.
I like it.
Yeah, so
you're
find
right,
is
this
a
was more fun than it sounded.
Yeah, and it's very powerful. This is easily the single most powerful command we have yet done. And in actual fact, it has an extra power we're going to look at next time.
Oh, cool.
So, we have so far used this command for the purpose of finding things and just listing them.
Right.
So they just spit out. But actually, we can make it do something to every file it finds.
Can we make it ding?
Well, ding.
Oh, sorry, that was last week.
But no, let's say you're looking for every PowerPoint file that's bigger than 500 megs and you want to delete it.
Yeah.
You can do that in one command with find. And if you get your rules wrong, you can get yourself into really deep
trouble. I was going to say, that's really dangerous, Bart. You're not going to teach me how to do that.
I am, but I'm going to put more exclamation points around it than you could possibly shake a stick at, right? But that is really what you want to do. And in fact, it's also going to lead into another one of my nerdy t-shirts. So you know the way we had a whole lot of fun about to be or not to be as a regular expression? I have another t-shirt, and it is a find command, which... No, I'm going to leave it until next time. It's a find command that's a joke. Oh, okay. So that's two pieces of nerdy.
Hopefully we'll be nerdy enough by the time you're done with us to get it.
I hope so. I'm not going to say anymore. I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
So that's one of the things we're going to do next time. Another thing we're going to do next time is for OS X people only. So find is a Unix Linux command. It's on Unix, it's on Linux, it's on OS X. It's all over the place. But OS X, we have Spotlight in OS X, and Spotlight is really quick at searching. Because it's not really searching. What it's actually doing is it keeps an index of what's on your hard disk and it only searches the index. The find command is actually searching your hard disk, which is why it gets slow, which is why the minus max depth is important. But that index that Spotlight uses exists within OS X, and the good people at Apple gave us a terminal command that can tap into that index. And so anything you can do in Spotlight, you can do from the terminal if you know how. And that's something we're going to look at next time as well.
Oh, cool. Now, I had asked and you said you were going to tease it at the end. Like right now, I've just run the terminal command and asked it for everything bigger than 1 gig. And that's why I was finding those videos I wanted. If I wanted to spit that out to a file?
Well, you could just pipe it like before, just arrow to a file. But then they're just in a file. The bit I was teasing was the fact that you could actually make find.
Oh, action on it.
Yeah. So if you just use the arrow and then a file name, it'll pipe them into a file like everything else because it's just output.
What was so the go arrow back to our again? Plumbing. So what do I do?
The greater than sign and then a file name.
But where's the pipe go?
So the full command, then at the very end of the command, pipe file name. So not pipe, greater than sign.
Ah, why did we say pipe? I always thought it was
I don't know.
Pipe.
We both did it. No, pipe is to send from command to command. Arrow is to send to a file. You don't want to send the output of find to a command. You want to send the output of find to a file.
Right. So piping is to pipe it to another. That's the plumbing thing.
Yeah, so piping joins commands, and our redirection, as it's called, sends to files.
Okay, cool. Look at that. I have a text file with all my giant files, so I can go beat them into submission.
Very good.
This is going to be awesome. I mean, most of them are movies that I downloaded, but I'm just really excited about this because there's some stuff in here like... The Apple Blacklist Me number 2.mp4 from MacBreak Weekly. No, probably don't need that.
Not that MacBreak Weekly isn't great. But.
Oh, no, you know what those are? Sorry, now nobody cares at all. I'm just blathering on here. Those are episodes of MacBreak Weekly that I was on. I think that's why they're in there. Yes, I need to keep them forever. All right. Well, this is really cool, Bart. You were right. This was not very vegetable-y at all. This was pretty fun.
But, you know, pretty powerful. So
yeah.
I think I called it beefy last time.
Yeah. It was good and chewy, but useful chewy.
So now, I don't know when we're going to do this next, because I have something else really fun planned to talk to you about in 2 weeks. 1 week time?
1 week, 2 weeks? Who knows? Maybe we have three times in a row.
The next time I'm here, right? The next time I'm here, I have something non-terminal related as a sort of a palate cleanser that's really cool. And I'm just going to tease it at that.
All right. Sounds good, Bart.
Okay. Until then, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind us up for the week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mega Learning at BlueMegaLearning.com, makers of Clarify. I love that Arthur sent it a dumb question. I would like to see more dumb questions. And you can send that and your comments and suggestions by emailing me at Allison@podfeet.com. And on Twitter and app.net, I'm also at Podfeet. Check out the NoSilicast Google Plus community. That's one of the places where I'm announcing the live shows now, because now we're using Google Hangouts on air. And I think it's going really well. We're getting bigger chat rooms. And probably the best thing is nobody gets ads anymore. So it's not a lot of interruptions. We were getting a lot of weird ads, foreign language ads. It was very strange in some of the other services. We're still struggling with how to get a few things set up in there, but I think it's working surprisingly well, actually. But if you were in the NoSilicast Google Plus community, you would have seen a bunch of great discussion, people asking questions of each other this week, and been notified of the live show. So that's kind of fun, too. Anyway, if you want to go to that, go to podfeet.com/Google+. That's the easiest way to get there. And let's see, speaking of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilicastaways. Even Dorothy is back for once, and New York Linda came back. We haven't seen her in a really long time, and as always, Rose, the queen of the chat room, is there. And so you can come and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilicastaways. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.